Good, hi. Yeah, welcome to this Lightning Talks. The Lightning Talks are going to be 40% in German and 60% in English. And I have to say, enjoy yourself and have fun. Thank you.
Hello? Hello? Sound? Can I get sound? Hello? No sound. Muss das Teil in der Tasche anmachen?
Sound? Better. So hi, I'm Hannes. I'm the Lightning Talks moderator. I want to keep it short. I've gotten several PDFs on a USB stick. There are people who want to present with their own laptops. They are scheduled at the end or to the end because I don't like to replug everything because we are short on time. So I will start with the list of the talks. I will simply go through as noted in the wiki, and if someone is around who wants to present that talk, he just comes in front. Okay, so we start with the plagiarism detection. Is she around? Deborah Weber-Wolf? No? Then the Vidalia project. Jeff, do you need anything? No, you have to. Can use that one if you want. Okay.
Hi, my name is Matt Edman. I'm the developer and project leader of sorts for the Vidalia project. If you were at Roger's Tor talk yesterday, you may have heard him mention Vidalia a couple times. Sure. Can everybody hear me now? Okay. All right. So if you've never heard of Vidalia before, it's an effort to build a cross-platform, nice, usable GUI for Tor. It's written in C++ using Qt4. If you've downloaded Tor from the website using the Win32 or the OS X bundles, you probably already have Vidalia. For those who haven't, I'm just going to run through some screenshots real quick. Vidalia is meant to be small, unobtrusive. It, for the most part, just lives in your system tray as a little icon. You right-click on the icon, you get some more options. If you double-click on the icon, you get bigger buttons with some of the things people usually click on and buttons we really want you to click on, like the setup relaying button. There's also a network map, so you can see an approximate geographic distribution of the Tor network and the path that your traffic takes as it bounces around the network. It's also, we try to make it easier to configure your Tor, particularly as a relay. So if you want to set up a normal relay or a bridge, hopefully that's not too much trouble. We also have a message log, so you can see what your Tor is doing without having to go out and find a file in your file system and cat it or something like that. And then some built-in help documentation for most of its features. But what I really want to talk about is the things that I want to do within the next year and some things that I could really use some help doing. For one of them, you probably noticed that the network map isn't terribly aesthetically pleasing. It's kind of grainy if you zoom in. The points aren't clickable and the circuits aren't clickable. So we want to make that a little bit better. One of the options is KDE's Marble widget. It probably needs some hacking to be useful for us, but I put together a quick little proof of concept, and that's what it looks like. So it looks a lot nicer. The points are actually clickable, but we still need to hack on Marble a little bit to like make the circuits clickable, and still kind of slow. Some other things, if you were at Roger's talk, you heard him mention UPnP support. It would be really nice if when people want to set up relays, if we can help them configure their NAT for port forwarding or whatever. So maybe that will make it easier for people to set up their own relays. Another thing is new versions of Tor come out quite a bit. I think there's been like four new versions in the last 2 weeks or something. So It would be great if we could alert users when these new versions are available and offer to download and install them for them. Vidalia isn't released quite as frequently, but still want to do the same thing there. Another thing are status events. A lot of times if something goes wrong with your Tor, a message just appears in your message log, and you don't think to look there, and you don't know something went wrong. So it would be nice to build an interface for letting people know about these events in a way that doesn't really annoy them. So maybe you hate writing code. That's fine. We need help from all sorts of people. If you're like hacking with Photoshop or GIMP or something, we could use some icons. Right now, the icons in our system tray, they're not animated. They don't do anything. It would be nice to show some sort of action when the user's browsing so they know that their traffic's actually being anonymized through Tor. Another thing we'd like is a logo. We don't really have a logo of our own. We've just sort of been pilfering Tor's onion for a while, so it would be nice to have something better than that. Multilingual people. We have about 16 translations right now. None of them are entirely complete, and some of them are wrong. So like, I heard that our cookie authentication in Norwegian was actually translated as cake authentication. So you know, even if there is a translation in your language, it would be great if you could go through the existing stuff, improve it, find out what's wrong. There's some strings that are probably still in English, so if you could translate those, that'd be great. Or start your own translation, that's fine too. If you're an academic usability sort of person, we'd really like to do a formal user study. The approach to implementing features we've taken so far is find out what people yell at me the most about and then implement that. Which is maybe not the best approach, but I guess it's worked so far. But if you would like to organize a formal usability study as maybe as part of a class project for HCI people or something, I'd love to be a part of that. If you like doing tech writing, our help documentation for the built-in help browser is fairly limited, so we could really use some help expanding that. And also translators, we need some help translating the help documentation. That's only in three languages, I think. And of course, we need everything that all of the every open source project needs, like some constructive feedback. If you want to say Vidalia's bloated crapware, that's fine. But something more helpful would be great. Good bug reports, those are always useful. Something better than it doesn't work. Feature suggestions, I'm sure you have ideas that I haven't listed up here and maybe aren't on our to-do, so if you want to let me know about those, I'd be happy to hear about them. Of course, everybody can edit our wiki. If you tried to run Vidalia and you ran into some problems, just add that to the wiki so other people can benefit. If you're interested in any of this, we have a lot of development resources available. Our Subversion repository is, of course, public. We have a wiki, bug tracker, stuff like that. Most of the development discussion goes on in our IRC channel, so feel free to stop by and talk to us there. Or you can email me, or I'll be around for the rest of the day. So if you're interested, let me know. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Thanks a lot. So the next is Power Structure Research with Pearl TCL on Bertelsmann, which is sadly canceled. The preview was quite nice. Then the next would be Console Hacking, State of the VII, is Bushing and others around? Anyone? No one. Free communication without data orientation? Rolf? You need anything? Browser? No. No? Okay.
No, I don't need. Yes, I don't need anything. I don't want to waste time with some not functionality techniques. What I want to tell you is I don't want to be the 171 first who talks about data retention. We heard about lots in the last 4 days. What we heard is we should have go into resistance. That's the most important thing that we should do, and all you know that. That's not my issue. The next is we have a lot of technical possibilities to go around or to get rid of it. It's only a workaround. In the end, we should get rid of it totally. But now the only thing we have is the techniques, using the techniques. We will do that. I'm sure that any one of you here and the other guys in this house will use the techniques we have, just like strong encryption or Tor or OTR or anything else we have to don't give them our data. But that's just us, a few thousand people, but we are 81 million in Germany, and how to get the others? And that's what I want to give you to think over. People, all of us, that's me too, we are hunters and collectors. And so my question was, why is payback functioning and why doesn't PGP is 10 years old, why doesn't anybody uses PGP? Okay, it's not the strongest encryption, I know that, but they don't do it. Why don't they do it? Because they have to do additional things to get the functionality they had before. So they won't do it. I asked a friend of my daughter a few days before, why don't you do it? And the answer was, yes, you are right. That's not the answer on my question. So we have to do what payback does. We have to give them something to get them, to protect them from themselves. That is my message today. We have to think over what can we do to give them an additional benefit when they use the techniques we have. What I did to collect the ideas you have, I made today, I set up a new web page that is Volksvernetzung.de, not Volksverhetzung, Volksvernetzung, you know. Yeah? So I'm German and it's a German page, of course. It's set up a few hours before. You may go there and write in, it's a wiki, write in your ideas. The first idea I had, I talked to Padaloon and he said with the Fürbud I can make one of those things working is my cell phone. I have a contract that is a flat rate into the fixed net in Germany. And I think lots of you have, and other people out there also, we will create a button which says free public phone. So if you find someone with this button, you may change the cell phones, not to get stolen, so you have to get something for it, and call someone, your friend, your grandma, and anywhere else, and if they track our data, the data retention will be totally confused then, because anyone calls to anyone, and that is my idea. What I talked with Padaloon and we will do with the Fürbud in the next weeks. I think we will do something on that. So please think about ways to give the people out there some additional benefit, collecting points, and give them when they have 10,000 points an inflatable ball. It's okay. They do it with payback also. So. They are hunters and collectors. Think about that and help them to protect them from themselves. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, the next one is also cancelled. So Netzim is presented behind because he's using an own laptop. So next would be Andrea, useful automation, how to destroy fingerprints. hoch?
Ist er nicht? Gerade eben hat er noch.
Will er nicht.
It wasn't me.
Was your USB stick here? So, do we have any presenter who's on the list and don't need any slides? Or okay.
Yeah, I can do it without. I mean.
Okay. Then do it.
Well, I'm really sorry. It wasn't intended to do that. So, you could see maybe if it were working that I said, "How to destroy your fingerprints?" question mark, because there is no easy way right now. But we need to find a way to do that. So I tell you a little bit about how I came to that topic. So, you know, in Germany we have to do the fingerprints into our passport now, and we can fake them, and we also... Yeah, but this doesn't help, because then in the end, when you come to a pass station, if you go through, they will just see that it is not yours, and you will undergo even more control, and that is not what we want. What we want is, we want to say to them, you don't get our fingerprints. And we want to do that because we can do it. There is no law saying that we have to give them our fingerprints. Even if we don't do it, we don't have to pay anything or anything. They just don't get our fingerprints, and we get one without. So, and this is why we want to do that. It was just a fat 32. I didn't do anything.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, and
it's all okay.
I looked a little bit on the net what possibilities are there, and basically you can burn down the upper skin of your fingers, and it really hurts. So, or you can take formic acid, in German that's Ameisensäure, and apply it to it, and then the skin, you can peel it away. But that also hurts, it's acid. And the next way... is that, I don't know it in English, this was a word I couldn't find, you can abschleifen, abfeilen, to sand it away, okay. And this also really hurts, and it's bloody and messy, and you don't want to do that. And we are looking for, and I'm looking for, an easy way to do that, and this is why I want to give this talk, because I need ideas. And I want to have your feedback. What can we do? What we will try in the next couple of weeks, we will try to do that step by step. So formic acid is also in some medical patches that you can loosen some strong, if you have really strong skin, you can loosen that up and maybe then sand it away. So we will try a little bit of that. But nothing of that is easy, and we want somewhat your ideas to that, so you can email me, and this is what I needed the slide for. It's fingerprints at Andre with a J in the end. Schulke, S-C-H-O-E-K-E. Just I write it down here, right? Can I just write my email there?
Yeah, sure. It's not an English layout.
It's also in the wiki, and we need everybody. So if you have an idea, mail it. If you want to help us by being a test subject, mail me. If you know a skin doctor, I really want to talk to some skin doctors, because it's not only about getting it away, but also to stop it from regrowing that fast. Because if you find an easy way, it's only a way for 2 days or so, and maybe you want it longer. And so I look also for some advice from skin doctors and so on. So everybody, just write me a mail if you have an idea. That's basically all.
Transplantation.
Oh, yes. Thank you. That was good. So we found out that we can fake the fingerprints. We all saw that on video. And with the Formic ASIC patch you get from the pharmacy, you can basically peel the real skin away and put the fake fingerprint on it, and it's indistinguishable. Even when you look closely, you cannot see that you have something else in there. That's something interesting we found out. And also, when you were not in the biometric talk yesterday, you can use a soldering iron to paint funny pictures on your fingerprints. So. But that really hurts, so don't do that. Okay, so if you have idea how to do that, if you had problems with your fingerprints, wanted to get them away, just please write me. We need a lot of ideas to find something really easy to get rid of them. That's all.
Thanks. Yeah. Okay, the next would be Dirk Krzyżanowski of on topic city top level domains as basis of urban identity. You gave me slides.
Yeah, hello. My name is Dirk Krzyżanowski, and I'm founder of the Dot Berlin initiative for a top level domain for the Berlin community. I hope slides.
Yeah, they're popping up.
Opening one day. Yeah, and as the last 2 years, I'm trying to inform you about what's going on with top-level domain names, especially city top-level domain names, and what's going a little bit on at ICANN, who will issue these new top-level domain names. As you know, these top-level domain names are basis of our and the domain names are basis of our communications. If you use them for email, for websites, and even for OpenID, you need top level domains or at least URLs. And so that's what I'm going to talk about today. As you can see, there are meanwhile, in change to last year's presentation, top-level domain name initiatives not only for Berlin, but also for Hamburg, for Paris, and for NYC, that's New York City. And there are a lot of other initiatives for regional top-level domain names. The Scots want to have one, the Basques want to have one, the Galicians, the Bretons, and so several cultural and regional communities want to have their own top-level domain names and already founded initiatives and will apply at the next possibility at ICANN. The timeline for these top-level domain names, when will they be available, is ICANN, as you know, is having application windows where you can file a top-level domain application, and the next window for filing such an application will be probably end of 2008, so in the fourth quarter, and it's expected that beginning of 2009 these new top-level domain names will be available. But beside that, where is it? Beside the city top-level domain names, there will come a lot of other top-level domain names. As you can expect, .shop, .web, .arc, or archive, or .library, or something like this. We will see top-level domain names like .ibm, or .mac, or .apple even, or for social communities like MySpace, Facebook, even Google is thinking about having its own top-level domain name for their customers. We will see top-level domains like .bank, Interbank Exchange, or .iban, or .giro, so making financial transaction more reliable. And we will see surname top-level domain names. So imagine all the 3 million people in the U.S. having Smith as last name, and they can have an own namespace. So that's what I want to give as an update from ICANN and the top-level domain namespace. There was a question there.
How about .Taliban or .terrorist?
No. So that will probably not happen because ICANN has new rules on top-level domain name approval, and any top-level domain name which is against morality or public order will not be approved by ICANN. That's a U.S. Department of Commerce and Defense, which more or less controlling the internet in a top-level domain name space, and that's their idea how the namespace should look like.
Okay, thanks. Okay, the next would be Marcel on the Human Future Optimization Project International.
Test. So, where do you put this thing, and will it crash the computer again?
Well, we'll see. No crash.
So, this is my first talk, and I'm a bit nervous, but we should be able to overcome that. No, how do you use this stuff? Yeah, this. All right. So my talk is not actually about the thing itself, but about good reasons to do a world revolution. So, yeah, can you do it full screen?
I don't think so. Just.
Huh? Yeah. Shit. Mac. Yes. Cheers.
But we have this.
Yeah. All right, whatever. Yeah, that's it. World revolution is like, you all know this term, like, demolish the system and make a new system, which is quite a thing people do not like, because change is something that scares people, so world revolution is not something that scares them less. So, but actually, I think it's a good thing to do, to do a clean slate implementation of a world governance system. And so we set up the Human Future Optimization Project International. The funky name, it's because it has pi in its name and it's pi in the logo, and so it fits. So, let me explain this with a metaphor. Like, you all know Windows XP. It's not that bad, but it's not quite that good. So let's, for a second, use this analogy. So our perspective, we as mankind, we are Microsoft. And the time is 2007 right now. Equals 2002. This is the time when Microsoft released Windows XP Service Pack 1, which is something that works most of the time, but has some issues. And the product is democracy and free market economy, our current political system, which is compared to Windows XP SP1. It's not bad. It works, like, for most of us, so we can get our beer and we can watch TV and stuff. But there's a lot of problems with it, and the situation was no. Oh shit! Damn it! In 2002, when they released this, they had two options to go, like. They had this quiet building operating system, with problems, and one way to remove the problems is by doing a fresh start. Windows proper. They have quite an extensive research laboratory, so they are working on the Singularity kernel, which is some sort of microkernel, and it's clean implemented, and it's quite seems quite sane. And yeah, Windows could use a clean and sane RP. Anyone who has used a Win32 RP, it's a mess. And yeah, this Win file system they promised for Windows XP, and the Monad shell, which is actually implemented in Vista. They would have to break binary compatibility for that. So that was one option, and the other one was, of course, to do Windows Vista, and to not get into legal trouble, the trademarks, and Windows proper, they don't have a trademark, they didn't do it. And their decision was to do Windows Vista. So after being postponed several times, Microsoft released Windows Vista to the wild on 13th January of 2007 with several promised features cut because they could not get them to work. This is like, they had themselves problems implementing this stuff, so it worked, and it works and is stable. So they just couldn't finish, and they left it out. So the product, it's like, if you compare Windows XP to Windows Vista, it's not like such a big advantage, and it doesn't fix many of the real problems. So to play our analogy, so we, as a civilization of human beings, our current political system is democracy and free market economy in most states, and many consider this to be the best of all available alternatives. And so our options right now are what evolves from the current state, like capitalism plus some years, all this democratization movement the US has started successfully in Iraq and stuff, and kind of like that, you know what I mean. And the other one is to make a fresh start and do things from the blank sheet. And our decision is not yet made. And which is good, because we can still do it. And the reasons, I think a fresh start would be preferable is to... it's about freedom for the design of your new society society governance system. You have many of the constraints. If you work with a product you have and you just are able to improve upon it, you have to many things you can't just change them. You can only make small changes bit by bit and stuff. You can't just you can't change the structure because it's you can't do it. You can't change the structure without doing a fresh start. So many of the constraints, if you do try to do it from scratch, are gone except loss of nature. And Murphy's law, and it gives you a chance to do a topology which is target directed. Like, you want to achieve something, like make humans happy and improve upon everything and save the environment and increase efficiency and all this stuff. And so, if you have a blank sheet, you can think of a structure, ways to achieve this without being bound to the current implementation of our system, which is Windows XP like. And efficiency is defined as what you get out from something. divided by or per what you need to do for it. So there's a lot of way. There are many ways to target efficiency if you do it from scratch. You can learn from experience and avoid the silly mistakes you have made the first time. So there are many problems in our current political system, and we could just design them away and let them not develop in the first place. And last but not least, if you depreciate the craft, so all the leftover stuff, you don't have to fix the old bugs. So you just all the problems of the old system, by doing a new implementation, you can just push them away, out of sight, they're gone. You can concentrate on your new start and make that polished, make it proper, make it clean, and make it work. So that's about it. At the end, thank you for listening. I've set up a poll at this website where you can, not everyone is probably the same opinion that we should do something like world revolution or stuff, and or that it's even possible or we need it and stuff. And yeah, it would be cool if you would voice your opinion on that. And yeah, last but not least, hack the planet. I cheer.
Thanks. Dein USB Stick. Hey, USB Stick. Your USB Stick. Your USB Stick. Gonna the next. Okay, then that's about UniHelp. Yeah. Do you need anything?
No, only the logo.
Okay, hello. My name is Markus Schneider and I'm a member. Okay, eigentlich wollte ich auf Deutsch reden. Do you want to choose better English or German? Okay. I try in English, I hope so. Yeah, we are a student project, and we work in a non-profit organization, and we have a social networking for students only in the city of Magdeburg. And we developed our framework in the last 3 new years, and we have a lot of cool features and functions, and our idea is to bring our framework open source, that every people or every students all over the world can use them and make their own network with students on their university. And this is because an interesting idea, because we are not interested in collecting data from our users or just have a big use to look on private, on the data privacy and something else, and make there a big notice only on this design of our framework. And if you are interested, you can write an email. And our idea is, when we have more networks, that the network like peer-to-peer connected to each other, that the students can also exchange. And this is a complete new idea, because I don't know if anything if anyone has do this before, and so we just interested in people to join us to develop our framework and to make give an alternative to the big companies, to they only want to collect our data. So thanks for listening.
Thanks. Yeah, the next talk will be, okay, that's again cancelled, on EU EPLI and community patents, software patents reloaded.
Do you know, put it full screen?
This one, full screen. No. Full screen. Anyone knows how to put that full screen? There's no full screen.
Sure.
On the what?
No, full screen. Normally it's F11 on.
No. There's no full screen. No, start your talk.
Okay, thanks.
Hello, hello. Okay. My name is Benjamin Arion. I work for FFI Brussels, the Foundation for Free Information Infrastructure. And our association has been created in 1999, and we have been fighting software patents since then. I've somehow started the Eurlinux petition in 2000. Maybe some of you have signed it. And we somehow managed to get enough trouble for the software patent directive that was rejected by the European Parliament on the 6th of July 2005, which was 2 years ago. And 2 days before the vote, the pro-patent camp, which was mainly the BSA and ECTA, which regroups Philips, Ericsson, Alcatel, and so on, called some MEPs in the right-wing part of the European Parliament to ask to reject the directive, which is somehow uncommon for a second reading of a European proposal. And they asked for a rejection of the directive because they feared that our amendments, which were against of the patents, had somehow a majority in the European Parliament. And they said, at least at that time, they said that they could get software patents through another way in Europe. And some of the MEPs, like Alan McCarthy from UK, said on her blog or website at that time that they would reopen the issue with the community patent. At that time, I didn't understand what it was about, and I didn't saw how you could change the legal situation in Europe with this community patent, which doesn't touch what is patentable and what is not. And the whole trick right now is to say we have the European Patent Convention, which says that computer programs are excluded from the field of patentability, and the next article says that they are excluded as such. And the European Patent Office interpret these terms as being if you claim in your patent that it's somehow implemented in software, they will probably reject it. But if you claim that you claim a machine that has certain features implemented in software, then they will grant you the patent. So and this was the case in the last Amazon one-click patent that has been rejected some weeks ago by the EPO, and one of the examiners said, somehow this trick is well known by all the patent attorneys, and that's the way they get software patents in Europe. Now the situation is that for all 32 members of the European Patent Convention, which is an internal governmental convention, signed by most European member states, that you have centralization of granting of patents. So if I want a patent for France, I can go to the EPO and have a patent for France without going to the French patent office. So the granting side is centralized. Now the post-granting side, which is the court, is left to the member states. So when you have somehow to attack a patent when it's granted by the European Patent Office, you have to go in several member states where it's delivered in front of each court to either cancel it or fight against it. And the idea is that since I think it was in the end of the 60s, was to create a central court for patents in order to get one one patent, one ruling. And so there is the EPO was doing lobbying somehow in the European Parliament in 2005, and one of the lobbyists who left this who left his job, the European Patent Office, in as a representative in Brussels, said the acrimonious debate over the proposed directive on computer implemented inventions might never have arisen if the patent litigation system in Europe had been unified, thereby eliminating the possibility of disparate national rulings on the same patent matter. So it means that the centralization of the especially validity, because what the patent people wants, the patent establishment wants, is to create a central patent court for validity. So it means if our association wants to go to this court and say the law is exclusive of the patents and this patent should be rejected, the court will say, oh, well, we know about this story, we interpret the law this way, and we follow the case law of the EPO. So the result of this centralization of the court system can be the same as the directive on software patents, which would legalize the thing, but it will legalize it by case law and centrally over all over Europe. And that's basically the danger. Right now, it can be really worse, because in terms of damages, when you go, right now the litigation is country by country, so when you go to litigate against an opponent in France, the judge will award the damages for France. But when you have this court system which is centralized, the court will calculate the damages over bigger markets. So if your company is somehow affected by this software patent issue, where the damages are calculated in number of copies of the software distributed, the consequences for your company can be even worse. So now you have this project of signing the European Patent Litigation Agreement, which was international treaty project similar to the European Patent Convention, but somehow it conflicts with the EU system, which are the 27 member states. So right now the idea is to get the same system, the same proposal as this EPLA, but somehow in the EU framework. And this, when it comes to those kind of decisions, requires unanimity in the council. So if the council managed to get no veto rights from Poland or some countries that doesn't want this centralization, they get a central court in Europe. Now, this will change with the new Lisbon Treaty, because the whole voting system will switch from unanimity to qualified majority, which requires 66% of member states to have to pass a decision. And so what will happen in the near future is that the Slovenian presidency and the French presidency will try to push for having a central court for patents and the committee patent, which is somehow where some delegations want still to have this central court, which is below the European Court of Justice, competent for both for European patents, which are not committee titles, and also the future committee patent, which is one patent granted for all the 27 member states. So I finished. Basically, right now the fight, why it's not progressing, is because there is a fight between people who want to separate validity and infringement. And for example, when a company accuses me of patent infringement, I counterclaim that the patent is not valid. So and somehow this issue about infringement and validity is there for 40 years. So it means that somehow this issue is old, and maybe they won't manage to get any political decision. So right now that is the status, and I want to finish. Thank you very much.
You're the next. That's cool. Yep. No. Which one? The Electra? The Electra, Ravi?
die war.
Hello, my name is Markus Raab, and I'm a developer of the Electro Initiative. Okay. Linux configuration is a mess. Of course, there are many, many things which we have get used to and which are very good and which won't be replaced. One of them is that the FIS, the file hierarchy standards, give very good choices where to put configuration. Then the other point, which is very suitable, that it is done for humans. So it is readable and editable. And I don't think that at any time it will be desirable that we lose the ability to edit with the editor. But what is the problem, and where comes Electra in it? There is often a need for an ARP for access to key value pairs. The whole idea is to get a large namespace where the whole configuration lies. Then there should be some standardization of the semantics. For example, that Steuerung and Open has its place where all programs can get it, and to build an ecosystem. The ecosystem can be showed as that the user does not only configure programs, but also other tools need access to it. Electro is a library which is very light. It has no dependencies, and an exact documentation, and a large testing framework. We will release in the next year the next stable version, which will be supported for at least 1 year. I will lose some words about the application program interface. It basically consists of three classes. One of them, the key database, provides the access to the where the configuration will be stored in the end. It gets and sets key sets, which is a set of keys, and the key is an atomic unit where the value is stored and also a comment. Let's introduce how we can fix the problem with the global namespace. There is a system tree where all the configuration, like in etc, is now. There can be various database backends. The idea of it is because there are various requirements. For example, there can be performance issues for many keys, but other applications more need have security issues. For example, etc Shadow. It would be desirable to have ACLs so that every password can be changed without a setuid program. But others, for example, Apache, the users want their old Apache configuration files. And here comes the clue: you can mount in at a point. Under system SV Apache, the Apache configuration will be used in. I can't show it because on this computer it is not installed, but it works now in the current release candidate. Now I show you some things which will give you an idea how flexible it is. You can export and import trees or the whole configuration. You can net cut the XML files over the network or whatever you want to do with it. Of course, you can do, and there is a GUI edit tool for the whole configuration. You can make in Python network services which put a get where you can show the configuration or change it. And I will give you a big picture of the thing. And the configuration utopy is that all that the programs use an abstraction layer, which makes them portable to different systems and to do every desirable configuration format and database. There's many people involved, and I hope some of you are interested and may join us too. Thank you for listening.
Yeah, thanks. So the next talk is about towards the free software world. Sorry? There's one in between. Okay, the game. Once you know the rules, you can never stop playing. You gave me slides?
Yeah.
Where?
Game talk.
Ah, that one. Okay.
Can you hear me? Yeah, all right. Okay, so this is something different without any computers. It's about a silly little game, which is actually a kind of virus for mind virus for people. So I will now infect you with this virus. If you don't want to, you can just close your eyes, close your ears, and not look. Now, it's a really simple game. It's got three rules. Oh. I'm sorry. This makes it a little strange. So, it is a little more strange. All right. So, rule number one. Once you know the rules of the game, you're playing the game. So, this will be you in a few seconds. Number two, whenever you think of the game, you lose it. And number three, if you lose the game, you must announce it to all other players in your vicinity and are then safe from losing for 30 minutes. So essentially, the goal of the game is to forget about it, which is rather difficult if you're surrounded by people who also play the game and continuously remind you that they lose. So now that you know the rules, you all lost. And you'll find that once you maybe go home and look at the recording and watch this talk again, you lose again. And then you look at other recordings and think, oh no, I lost at the last recording, and then you lose again. And then you, I know, go into town and see at the shop new games, and then you lose again. And it's a bad thing. I learned about that game from a guy from the University of Cambridge, and that was about 8 months ago, and I lost about, I don't know, at least five times every day. And of course, told it to the people in my vicinity and now to you, and I don't think I'll ever stop losing. But nobody seems to hate me for it. That's a good thing. So you can tell it to other people and spread the infection. So it's really in the core of your brain after a while. And yeah, that's all already.
Thanks. Okay, now we have the presentation towards a free software world.
Yeah. Hello. So towards a free, my name is Mario Behling. They have invented a nice title for me here, Matchmaker. I bring people together for this project, Fosbridge. It's titled Towards a Free Software World because I think we can only build a free software world not just by programming it and by working on it. We have actually to involve people. And our goal is not just involve people by doing projects here in Europe, but actually for for what's the next slide? For with so what we want to do with FOSS is development collaboration. I don't know. Maybe a lot of you know development aid. Now the new term is development cooperation, because we don't just want to give passive aid. We want actually to collaborate. And free and open source software is a great tool to collaborate for mutual benefit. So the project, what's it about? Project to support development cooperation with free and open source software. Set that focus to small and medium-sized enterprises. So we actually want to work with companies. And it's a project consortium from Europe. It's three countries involved, Germany, France, and Spain. And we have local partners in Asia. Right now we focus on Vietnam. Vietnam, why? Because 2003 they decided to switch their infrastructure to open source. Unfortunately, it's not that easy. Like, there's some lobbying of Microsoft going on and so on. I'm not going into detail now, you know, about these kind of things. And it's sponsored by the European Union, the German government, Spanish government, and has started in 2007 already. Who's involved? It's Invent of Germany, INRIA is an organization from France, IOIT, our local partner in Vietnam, and the associate partner Synetic. It's an organization promoting free and open source software in Spain. The goal, a few goals, increase awareness of free and open source software in Vietnam, development through FOSS education in Vietnam, education sector, business sector, increase expert knowledge on innovative FOSS business models in Vietnam. So what we do is bringing companies over to Vietnam to do joint projects. It's the next point. They could work together on a common source code, for instance, with a small spelling mistake, okay? Or like they could provide services together, do joint projects, even if they don't work together, they just use the same software. We hope at one point Vietnamese companies will contribute to the code, and so everyone has a benefit. And the last point, giving companies access to a new FOSS network and ecosystem. Normally, FOSS companies are not that big. We have a few big ones, which is MySQL. They participate somehow also in the program, but also they said like they don't have really the resources to participate as compared to Microsoft could just send someone to a country, and they don't care about the return, the immediate return of interest. So that's with small companies. There's always the question of resources and money. Okay, so what we do, activity, training, workshops on FOSS, workshops where you can get Linux certificates, studying business cases. We also do communications workshops. There's always the question of different cultures working together on joint projects. We even sometimes have difficulties here when people work together over mailing list and over tools. So there are some workshops. And and also how to create, for instance, open source communities, how to work with them. It's a question here, for instance. Activity number two, business matchmaking, actually bringing the companies together. And that's why I wanted to give this small talk here. Maybe some of you work in a small company, in a free and open source software company. Maybe they're interested. Please get in touch with me, or you can sign up on the website. The program has started, but we still invite new companies to participate. And there's also a support scheme available for the initiation period. So small companies could be eligible. For instance, we could support them with travel costs. It's financed by the European Union. We could talk to you. We could sometimes it's just bringing people in touch, yeah, because we have the local partners. We have the Institute of Internet Technology in Hanoi. So, if you're interested, just get in touch with me. Who can take part? Depends on open source strategy of the enterprise, so it has to be a FOSS company. If you use some not open source software, it's okay, but the main part should be free and open source software. Also the question of level and strategy of internationalization, so you should be a company that aims to work in with other countries or with in other regions or somehow with partners also. And it must be a EU company because it's EU financed, so must be a EU company. And of course, it also depends on the interest of companies in Vietnam to work together with you. Active participation as well. What already happened? We had workshops. We had meetings of over 40 European companies, no, over 40 companies, European and Vietnamese, in Hanoi in November. And so there are already 50 partnership contracts signed, articles on Linux.com, Heise.de, and others, you know, could also help your company. Some PR would be nice. Some Vietnamese companies taking part. I don't know if anyone knows some of them. We have one company even has 800 developers. So they are already quite large ones. For Vietnamese companies, though, in Vietnam, they don't make the big difference between force and so on. It's not so, you know, I don't know if anyone has worked here with people from Asia. They don't always make the big difference. For them, the idea is to create a business and to earn income, of course. What we want to help them, we want to show them or help them to do it in a free and open source ecosystem or environment. So, okay, some European companies at the end here. We have a Night Lab. Some people know this maybe. Bull France, Bull is quite famous. Gonikos, they're involved in the Linux project. Recently switched 13,000 telephones in Munich, in the city of Munich, to open source and voice over IP. So some companies involved here. Yeah, get in touch with me. Here's my contact details, or you can just have a look on our website, fossbridge.org. Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, the next talk will be on OLPC.
He's already, yes, but he's already gone. So I take over and do the talk for him. Okay.
Oh, okay.
Samuel Tan is gone.
Okay.
Should I take this?
No, you have slides on PDF. Then we should take those. That's your Mac.
So, Samuel Klein already left, unfortunately. He had to catch his plane. So I'll sort of speak a little bit for him now. And I'll speak about the plans that we made for the old PC developers program. So do you have a keynote? Okay. Wait. Okay. So, my name is Aaron Kaplan. We founded the old PC group, local group in Austria, and sort of we planned a new developers program for old PC. So the idea is how you get. Does that switch actually? Yes. How you get your XO basically. So there has been a big shortage in old PC laptops. Some part of it is because the production capacities are not fully up and running. The other part is like countries like Uruguay and Peru ordered, and there was a give one, get one program, which was only for the United States and Canada. And even Canada didn't get laptops for Christmas. So basically, I went there with another colleague of mine, Christoph, and we sort of complained a bit there. We went to Cambridge and we talked with them and said, you cannot exclude the community. And this was very well received. So I have very good news for you. Actually, my talk will be much shorter. Yeah, I have very good news for you. We have around 200 XOs per month coming in the new contributors program. This is worldwide, but still it's a nice thing. And basically, we set up a contributors program now, which does not only include developers, but it can also include like educators, graphics artists, artists in general, whatever. It's all documented there. And just watch this page. It will change a few times. It's a wiki. Samuel loves wikis. He's from Wikipedia also. He's very active there. So we'll have a contributors program where you basically register. You register your name, your address, your telephone number. This will be stored in a database. If your program application is like makes sense, you will basically get a laptop. And then we ask you, like, the main thing is, like, if this laptop stays at home in your place in the corner, it doesn't make sense. So what we would ask you then to do with the laptop in case you don't have time because you work for university, you have a job, etc., is that you hand it over to another interested developer or contributor or to your local Chaos Computer Club group. So what we had in Vienna was a group process. We had XOs and we shared them amongst each other. This also helped in community building. Now I think you still wanted to say a few words, yeah, right?
Yes, hello, my name is Chris Hagel, not the Christoph he mentioned who went to Boston with Aaron. So I joined OLPC Austria a few months ago and started developing different things. Okay, sorry, better now? Okay. So the point I wanted to make is, it's not, you don't have to be a developer, like Aaron said, to apply for this program. It's basically the idea what counts. There are many people scattered around the world which are like, have a bit of spare time, and if the project is not like huge, might want to join you on your idea. And if it's a small idea, it should be no problem. And if it's a big project idea you have, you can get together with the local groups around your place. You can get on the IRC channels. And usually people are happy to help you out with your ideas. So basically, we are also looking for anyone having questions. Okay.
We'll just hand out, like, still flyers that you can take home with the URL. And,
but I see we have a mic.
Right.
Okay. Just a quick question. Does the world include non-European Union countries like Croatia, for example?
Of course.
Just checking. Thank you.
This is a worldwide program, right? No, that was dedicated for the U.S., unfortunately. To give one, get one? Yep, I agree. Yep.
Is there a software simulation for
this? Yes, that's a good point, actually. Usually, very often, like projects which you submit there will run on an emulator, and there's quite a few options. One is VMware. You can download the whole image of the old PC laptop, and it runs on VMware. You can have a Ubuntu Live CD. You can have Ubuntu or Debian packages, which just change your window manager to the default window manager of old PC, to Sugar. Or you can have QAMO. There's a bunch of possibilities. Yeah. So very often what we end up doing when we code something for that is either we have an application which really requires the actual hardware, or we develop in the emulator on the local PC, and then just, you know, meet and test and have our jam and coding session, which is quite nice, actually. Okay, I think we shouldn't have questions. You said that, right? Okay. Okay.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Oh,
okay. So, we have the next talk by the same person.
That's because I registered SJ, who unfortunately couldn't make it. Is this one? So I'll talk more about like the thing which I'm more like personally more deeper involved, like and not, you know, representing any organization or so. This is this OLIS RNG project. Many of you know Freifunk, the Freifunk network. They use OLSR, and some of them also, some of the nodes also use the Batman protocol. So I wanted to briefly talk about. Come on, doesn't work here. I tried. Oh, here, okay, thanks. I wanted to briefly talk about our progress with working on OLSR, which has hopefully big impact on all the Freifunk-style networks in the world. OLSR is RFC 3626. It's called OLSR because it's open, optimized link state routing. It was a diploma thesis by Andreas Tønnesen in Norway, and it became the de facto standard of mesh protocols on layer 3 in all of these Freifunk, Funkfeuer, Athens, Wireless, etc. networks. Yeah? And since it was a diploma thesis, at some point you want the diploma thesis to be finished. So at some point you sort of become a bit sloppy with the code. It was a pain of the ass to maintain. There were only like patches all the time to it, and nobody really cleaned it up. What the effect was that it at some point became quite slow in the Freifunk networks. Now at some point people decided this is enough. Yeah? In Vienna, the Funkfeuer networks, people decided this is enough, we need to clean up. In Berlin, Elektra and a few others decided we need something new. So basically we have like the two branches now, evolution versus revolution. And our project is basically to clean up all this R and to make it very, very, well, performant. So this should be fish eye, not fishy. Okay. So what did we achieve in the last year? Main credits go to Hannes Gredler, Sven Ola Tücke, and Bernd Petrovic. We achieved that the fish eye algorithm finally works. Nobody noticed that it didn't work. Yeah. For years, yeah. So this works now. That means we have less packets going over the air. It means like there is no more air time for the actual data to go over the air. Then the main issue was the CPU load was much too high. This was the CPU load before on the Funkfeuer network in Vienna with 400 nodes. It was around 60%. Now it's here. It's under 1%. Actually, I exaggerated that graph because so that you can still see a green line. The scalability was like that before. The Dijkstra calculations for shortest path calculations from A to the internet, from a node to the internet gateway, behaved like that before. Now it's here on the green line. So we are pretty sure that it actually scales now. Of course, there might be issues, but we'll clean them up on the way. So briefly, to give you a preview of what's going to happen in the next probably year, there is still a bug now, which we're working on it. It's NLQ, the one parameter sometimes turns to zero, means like the route switches. It's not necessary, it's a bug. So in case you notice something like that in your Freifunk network in Berlin, have a little bit of patience, please, and give us good bug reports. Then we also learned that in Berlin, you have private IP spaces and you have a NAT somewhere, so your packets go out here that way. At some point, the route might switch to a different gateway, to a different DSL line. That means your session is still stuck here. The packets want to come in here now. It doesn't work. So we'll have a solution for that, hopefully soon. And then we'll also have a new algorithm called CSN, which is basically will again clear up the air a bit, less packets. All the topology information, basically regularly now OLSR sends out the whole topology graph of the whole network to the other nodes, right? This is like too much, so we can do much better by simply synchronizing only the differences. And then we are thinking about a new metric. It's called ETT. It's basically the well-known ETX metric divided by the bandwidth of the link. So you also recognize the bandwidth. And then something really sexy is going to probably come. I can't promise it 100% yet because it's like the hardest part is multipath routing. Basically what OLSR does now, it finds the best route in this dynamic mesh network. One single route. So all the packets, as long as this route is good, will go over that way. So what happens when all your neighbors have now nodes, and you could go around the buildings in different routes in parallel. You could send out different flows in parallel. So as soon as you have that, your network really grows. The bandwidth, the total bandwidth grows more or less, minus interference, with the number of nodes. Yeah, the more nodes, the more bandwidth. Okay, so this is like a very nice target for us. Okay, this is it basically. So the future looks bright. Thanks a lot for listening.
Thanks. Then laptop. No. Okay, so the next talk is on Sergio by Georg Janek.
Yes, hello, my name is Georg. I want to show you Sergio. And Sergio is basically a command line for the web. So we can call it with Sergio.net. A cookie, okay, don't need it. And we choose German, because my examples are in German. Again. Can I allow for this session? Okay. So, for example, we can type in DB for Deutsche Bahn, and then Berlin, comma, Hamburg. This is Deutsche Bahn, it's not me. Okay. So we come directly to the timetable of the Deutsche Bahn. Another example is we can do a phone book lookup of a German phone book. Let's say we look for somebody called Meyer in Dresden. Okay. They're full of cookies, the pages. Okay, so we come directly to the phone book page of this person, of the people called Maya. Oh my God, can I? Is it some way to switch it off? Okay, a third example, we can look for a law in a German. Where's the paragraph sign? There's no paragraph sign. Okay, so let's leave this example. We could look up also a law of a German in a German laws, and the keyword for this would be a paragraph. So basically, the idea is we always have a keyword, and then the arguments what we are looking for. And so we just don't need also to type all the stuff into this input field. We can also install a plugin. And then we can type all the stuff up here in this field, which I won't do now, but so it's not, you don't need to go always on this page. And some easy examples, let's look for in Google for something. It's just G. Or we just look in Google for pages only in a German language, which is done by GDE. And now we have only German pages. So let's see where the comments are stored. They're stored all in the wiki, which means that you can all edit them. Let's go for Google, the example. So this is the wiki page of a comment, and they start always with the definitions and then with the examples, and we just take a look to the definition. It always starts with a comment opening tag and the closing tag, and inside we have the attributes. The easy comments are just defined by a keyword, which is in this case G, and then we just put up the placeholders somewhere inside. We can also use some system variables like the language. So here it's put the language of the the language of the Sergio interface, which is used in the moment. So it would be translated into DE, and this would tell Google to show its interface as in German. A more complicated comment is a regex comment. So we can define a regular expression. And this catches basically all starting with a G, followed by two letters, and then followed by any string. And so this was a GDE comment, for example. We just look for pages in a certain language. And then they are all translated into this URL with $1 is this the language, and $2 is the the query. And okay, one another feature is we can avoid clashes of keywords by a language attribute. An example for this is the comment for Last.fm. I don't know, maybe you know it. It's a page for listening, for sharing music tastes, and you can connect to other people's. And there are several language versions, and they're all split up here with the same keyword, but every comment is assigned to a language. So we have, for example, the English version with language EN, language DE for the German version, and so on. So you can avoid clashes of comments with a language attribute. Okay, the last feature, you can set up user comments, which means that... Yes, thank you. My username is Jorgis in this wiki, so I defined my own user comments, which are only valid to me. So I defined an own comment to look up trains up from my home. So when I just want to use it, I go on my Search Hilo page. And here I just need to type in DB. Entschuldigung, größer als? Maybe. Yes, and just where I want to go. So, okay, let's take Hamburg, it's no umlaut. And yeah, it just knows it starts from Griebnitz, where I live, to the place where I want to go. And yeah. At the end, some tricks. The Deutsche Bahn has also a text version, which is called with DBT. And then you can use, maybe you don't know, just the number plates of the cars, like the abbreviations, which means BHH. And you're directly at a text version. Okay. So at the end, I think this is very useful for mobile phones, because when you have only 12 keys, you don't want to type or don't want to click lots of stuff. So, but the problem is I don't have a mobile phone yet with UMTS and I'm using internet. So if you would like to use it for mobile phones and want to give me some feedback, for example, what plugin is needed for what, how could I improve it, then I would be really happy to hear from you. Okay, thank you.
Okay, so the next talk will be about Lintronics, a snort-based RDS, if Emma Pschura is around. Doesn't seem so. So then about Omega Wiki from Pudrodoa and Blismach.
Yeah? Yes, it's a link of my Okay. I'm going to talk about Omega Wiki, which is a project that was formerly known under several other names like Ultimate Wiktionary or Wiktionary Z. This is a project to make a dictionary of all words of all languages and some more information. We just heard about the OPLC project. Much of the data which is in Omega Wiki currently is going into the OPLC project, just by the way. It's an open source open content and free collaborative project. That means it's based on MediaWiki plus some extensions. That means basically when software is at the point that this is possible, everyone can contribute to the project and enter dictionary data. Currently we have some 600 contributors. And the wiki is not open for public editing yet because of software problems which require that persons who edit do have some deeper knowledge of the inner functioning. This will be eliminated in the future. Software is at a point that we can prove that it shows some proof of concept and that one can see what is intended with it. When we look at a word, say you go in the wiki and let the wiki tell you what it knows about a word like L-A-N-G, then first you see that it happens to be present in several languages. There's no pointer here, but you can see from the side that there are many more. I just made a pretty short screenshot to get it here on this page. If you click one of those open by clicking on the plus sign besides them, oh, yes, each of those languages has the word which is spelled L-A-N-G. When you click one of those open, you get some structured information about that word. And also here you have just a little bit of it. In OmegaWiki, we deal with words and expressions. Sometimes you have expressions which convey one piece of information but consist of several words. So in English you have to ridicule someone, which can be translated to German jemanden durch den Kakao ziehen, but it doesn't make sense to retranslate it in English as to pull someone through the hot chocolate. Obviously that would be a mistake. So when it comes to translation, we have to consider meaning, not only words. And meaning is one of the things that we use in OmegaWiki to find and correlate translations. A single word can have several meanings. There are plenty of those which we use for joking, and OmegaWiki treats all words of all languages and all of their meanings. So here is an example which is not nicht besonders übersichtlich ist, but you can see there are three instances of long, and besides them you have several different meanings explained that they can have. In order to single out a specific meaning, we write something which we call a definition. Here is a list of definitions for the word, I don't know which one, in several languages. This is one meaning, and the definition has been translated between these languages. Okay, short break. Putting a definition towards a word is nothing new. That is something which every single language dictionary uses all the way since centuries. But in OmegaWiki, we tie together an expression or a word in a language together with its definition. And this gives a building block inside OmegaWiki, which is called defined meaning. A defined meaning is a word and a definition of one of its meanings pulled together. And only those things are being translated between languages. So we don't actually translate words, we translate defined meanings. So that in the process of translation, we don't lose meanings. There's a way to translate a word into the same language. This is synonym, and we call synonyms and translations. We treat synonyms and translations alike. Here is a list of some, what is it? I think it's the, I choose the German word Lehrer, and it has several synonyms and several translations in several languages. You see that some languages appear several times here in this list. These things are all identical except one. In the fourth row, you see that in the column under the heading identical meaning, there is no check mark. This is another interesting feature that we need to have. Translations need not be exact. Sometimes they are, sometimes they are not, and sometimes they can't even be exact. Okay, there's some. There exists a very well known scholarly thesis about that. Whoever is interested reads the pretty good Wikipedia article about it. Some translations are exact by their nature. Names of persons or places or technical terms usually translate pretty precise, and there's no way to confuse them. Others aren't. Just two simple samples. If you have the German word Schachtel, Kiste, box, they are all pretty much the same, but not quite the same. And sometimes you can use either of those words for a real word object, sometimes you can't. Another example is a differentiation in what we call the concept behind something. In English you have the word teacher, in German you have Lehrer und Lehrerin, but you can translate them between each other, and these translations are good and valid, and there's nothing to complain about. Only they are not when you have the English word, you have a choice how to translate it, and if you don't know the gender, you have either to make a choice or to circumvent this loss or this lack of information. Of course, you can always create exact translations for those by qualifying the words further. You say male teacher or female teacher, or you choose to say Lehrer oder Lehrerin in your translation. Fuzzy information, when it gets translated, usually ends up in losing information, a process which is also known as Stille Post effect. In OmegaWiki, we assume that translations are reflexive and transitive. That means when someone enters a translation in one direction, always the other direction, the reverse direction, is included automatically. And if two people enter translations and they share one word in one language, then we effectively have six translations by just using the fact that the translation of a translation is again a translation of the original. Yes. You see, at the lower end you have one and two, and you have this double arrow. So this reflects symmetry. These are taken care of by defined meanings. If you have ambiguities, you have several defined meanings with one word. And we do not translate words, we translate defined meanings. So we always take into account what the special meaning of a word is. The symmetry and transitivity helps us to reduce the workload which is needed to make a bilingual directory of N languages. With the method that OmegaWiki uses, it scales, the effort to make it scales about 2 times N. The classical method that publishers of dictionaries have used up to now scales with N square. That means collecting all data is much more efficient than just collecting part of all data. In OmegaWiki, you can relate something to expressions, you can relate expressions to each other, you can assign attributes to expressions, you can put them in collections. And one of the interesting collections is that once you have the grammar terms of a language in OmegaWiki, you can relate words and expressions to those grammar terms, which means that you classify them and that you then know how they are grammatically used in languages that have grammars. Okay, and also one of the goals which OmegaWiki has, but not started yet is to have inflected forms, forms changed by grammar of all words in the directory as well. So that in the end you could go to any website and point on any word and say, click on it and have it linked to OmegaWiki, and OmegaWiki gives you a complete rundown of all the grammar properties of this word, which language it is in, and what its meaning is, and how to translate it, and possibly anything more, where the Wikipedia article is about it, if there's any, and so on. So I thank you for listening, and if you want to play with it, go to the wiki. It's omegawiki.org.
Okay, so the next talk is about XMAME, virtual entity. Take that. I'll start the slides.
Okay, I start talking. Hello, I'm XMAME, and I'm here to present for the first time a new license, which I started to work recently. And this license is called Virtual Entity, and it's about licensing digital works, so net art and any type of file that will go through the net. Can you open it? Yeah. Okay. Okay. So that's just a splash. So, like, I have here a few assumptions, which are like, I started to think of what is a digital file and what's the difference with everything else. And one of the main differences is that any copy is exactly identical to the original. So we don't have any more this distinction. And in a certain sense, like, since a file through the net will proliferate and go through the net and all over, in a quite free way, I can imagine like internet and like digital creations are very similar to nature. In this sense, I think there is no owner of digital files. There is no owner of culture as well and of nature. So I'm thinking of a license to track the history of media files, because if it happened to you to work online and to put your works out there, you will be always very curious to know what happened to the files you made and where are they going and what is the connection. And like any other license I always try to use and experience was creating a distance between me or the creator of a file and who is using it. Because at the end, what I do if I use a Creative Commons is putting a link to the website, the Creative Commons website, and that's all. I would never know what are the people doing with my files, with the files I put online, and what's their destiny. As well, I think a license is not only should also like give some instruction about how did I create this work, how would I like this to be used, and or something to be shown, and I think it would be interesting to have a more direct connection between users and creators or different creators that share their works. So and create feedback system and a discussion about what happened to a file. So I was thinking that this license I'm talking about is not about distribution, is not about royalties, is not about lawyers, not about sustainability, and not about property. So we are not talking about these things. We want to do something else. I started to think about media types to be defined by a substance. So, like, divide them in a very simple way, like audio, video, text, picture. And I think metadata have a limit because they depend on format and formats and codec, and they cannot be expanded. Of course, I can expand metadata on a single file, but what I'm expanding will not be effective because, okay, we have one file and we have all the copies, no? If I edit metadata on one file, I will not affect all of the instances that are around the world of this file. So it will be just my own file that will start to go around and be copied with the new information I am going to add. So there is not an absolute reference that contains information around the file and its use. So what I was thinking, I started to think about creating a sort of soul of a file, which could be external to the single file and have a sort of soul kernel, like something that the main creator of the file, the person who makes a native file, will write this sort of metadata in a kernel, and he will own the permission of this soul. But the space of the soul will be expandable, so that you can add your logs on the souls. For example, I can say I use this text as a still as a part of a video and add this information to the text, to the soul of the text I took the reference from. So how to do this? The native file is something like a concept I'm talking about, which is like when you create a file for the first time, you know, and you put it online. In a sense, this is the very first. No, there's no original, but there is a first imprint online or on your own hard drive. You start this file for the very first time. You created it. Okay, that's where a file is born. And the absolute creator is the person who starts to make this first version of the file. And this virtual entity is also about creating a sort of like tracking the generations of files. So if a new file contains other files, you will have like these instructions, these addresses that will allow you to map through the different files that are that have been used to create the new one. So that's a bit like a schema. I have like foo.org, that's a video, and I have all of these foo.org that are around the net and can be copied on any server. And I have all of these that contain a sort of address to the soul, which is somewhere else. And every time some user adds some information in the logs part, every other file will be pointing to the same information. So this will grow, will tend to grow the soul or to die as well, you know. While the kernel will be owned by the person who starts the file. Yeah, it starts from a wiki. Eh? It's like I started to think from a wiki concept. It doesn't have to be that different. And so, like, how to link this? I was thinking of adding a sort of key code in the file header, and to check with a sort of MD5 or something similar the integrity of a file, so that you go to the real soul and not a fake soul. And then there is this is totally new. That's some possible development of such an idea. So, sorry. Yeah, can I go on? But what do you mean that I'm saying that this is free while I talk about versions and permissions, and is that like? You're not obliged to, huh? Like, no user is obliged to say, I use this. If you want to, you can add this information to the soul of the file. or if you have questions, if you want to go reach the main creator and talk to him, you can, but you don't have to. As well, I mean, I can imagine that such a system would be used, especially at the beginning, as a prototype by a few people, but then, like, do you want to make a soul of any file you do? Maybe not. But is there a file you want to make a soul for? Yes, maybe there's something you would want to do like this. So, like, there would be like a sort of soul repository where you like all these souls are stored with the informations. And I was thinking of a soul surfer because it's not necessary to use a browser, but maybe some other command line or something more usable for people to go and access these, like to verify the code that connects a certain file to a certain like bunch of information and go there and edit it. And then, of course, the anti-spam, because that could be really like evil. Eh? Of the soul, like the soul is open. I think like the main metadata should be owned by the creators, and you cannot come there and change it. The logs, I think that's tricky because if I put the logs that any person adding a log will own his own logs, if somehow that gets filled with spam, how do you delete that? So that's something to figure out still. I think, but something quite free. Like you have, the kernel is the hard part, let's say. The rest can be like more free. That's it. So if you have comments and suggestions, I'm really happy. At the moment, you cannot see that it's virtualentity.org. It's really new. It's a wiki right now. So if you want to write something about this, you feel free to go there and add your opinions. Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, so the next talk is about security and statistical analysis tools for the human rights community.
All right, my name is Annie Harrison. I'm from San Francisco. I work for an organization called Benetech, and we're based in Silicon Valley. Oops. So I want to talk today about a couple of our free software tools that we've developed for human rights organizations and how they're being used around the world. Since 1991, our human rights data analysis group, and you can read about them at hrd.org, has been developing statistical analysis techniques to analyze witness testimony and develop defensible evidence of large-scale human rights violations. This data is used by prosecutors and truth commissions to help establish a clear historical record. And to do this, we developed a tool called Analyzer, which is an open-source database tool based on the who did what to whom data model. And we use this tool to structure and quantify the sequence of events that take place during violations of civil and political rights. Now, we did this because most testimony and evidence about human rights violations is anecdotal data that can be manipulated, discredited, and distorted. We subject this data to statistical analysis that can be replicated by other people to verify the findings. We believe that scientifically defensible answers about the magnitude and statistical patterns of violence can help overcome partisan arguments about blame and victimization and that this data can be used to hold perpetrators accountable, end impunity, and begin the process of justice and reconciliation. We make our findings available to scholars, lawyers, historians, journalists, hackers, human rights and civil society groups, and the families of people who've been killed or disappeared. We analyze information from many sources, lots of different sources, including individual testimonies, legal depositions, surveys, administrative records from morgues and cemeteries, exhumation reports, prison, police, military, customs, and immigration records. And we encourage you to share and collect this kind of information when you come across interesting documents. To convert anecdotal information into information that can be used for analysis, we code the data in ways that allow each type of violation to be classified into consistent, repeatable definitions. When we quantify the total number of abuses in a given conflict, we determine where the reports overlap so that we can more accurately determine the number of victims or violations that we're working with. Now, we provide this training and support to local organizations, and we've worked with about 9 truth commissions around the world, including truth commissions in El Salvador, Haiti, South Africa, Guatemala, Peru, Ghana, Sierra Leone, Liberia, and East Timor. We also provide data analysis for NGOs in Bosnia, Chad, Colombia, Cambodia, Guatemala, and Sri Lanka. We provided analysis of mass human rights violations in Kosovo that were used in the war crimes trial against Slobodan Milosevic at the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And this same evidence is now being used in the prosecution of his co-indictees, the members of the former Serbian High Command. We just released a new report which provides a scientific estimation of the number of missing people in the Colombian state of Casanare, including those who have never been documented. We are trying to statistically document people who don't exist in the records. Our analysis suggests that between 30 and 40% of missing persons in this area in Casanare were unreported from 1986 to 2007. And this report is now being used by Colombian NGOs to assist further investigations of murders and disappearances across Colombia, where we believe there are a lot of mass graves. We're now working with the Liberian Truth and Reconciliation Commission to help them manage and analyze information from victim and witness statements from their 14-year civil war. In addition to the analyzer software, we've also developed MARDIS, which is a free open source database software tool that helps human rights investigators collect, organize, encrypt, backup, and distribute information bulletins about human rights violations. You can download, examine, and vet the MARDIS source code on SourceForge or up on MARDIS.org up here, and we encourage you to do so. It's customizable, it's open source, it's a Java-based tool that runs on all operating systems, and it's available in Spanish, Russian, French, Thai, English, and Arabic. I'd like to give you a quick example of the kind of threat model that this tool was designed to address. In August of 2005, a woman who works for Equitas, a forensics NGO in Colombia, had her taxi hijacked in Medellin, and she had her laptop stolen at gunpoint. Because she used MARDIS to encrypt and back up the sensitive witness testimony on her laptop, she could calmly hand over her laptop to her assailants without giving them a hit list of witnesses. So the robber got nothing but encrypted data. MARDIS is now being used in 15 countries around the world, including Colombia, Guatemala, Iraq, Nepal, Russia, Kenya, and Thailand, where a group of Burmese NGOs is using it to secure their data from intense surveillance from the Thai, Burmese, and Chinese intelligence authorities. In the US, where we have some human rights problems of our own, of course, MARDIS is being used to secure case information by attorneys representing prisoners at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. The largest MARDIS project is located in Guatemala City, where over 50,000 MARDIS bulletins have been generated to secure some of the 80 million documents in a huge recently discovered Guatemalan National Police Archive, which is the largest known human rights archive in Latin America. It's an amazing project. If you'd like to contact me for more information, please do go to our websites, email me at my address, or I'll be around here later if you have any questions. Thank you.
Laptop. The first one on MD5.
Yes. Hello. As we don't have so much time, or as I don't have so much time, I didn't produce any fancy slides or stuff. I just use a web browser and myself, and I hope it's enough. What I'd like to do is to introduce you to MD5 Cracker. It's a set of tools to reveal the strings out of MD5 hashed, out of an MD5 hash. You know, it happens, more or less often that you just browse the web, you know, and then I click around and see some weird stuff about database, and then you play around with the parameter, and I get something weird, which looks like an MD5 hashed string. And what I do then is I go to md5.cryptobitch.de and I enter the string, the MD5 hashed string. No, the MD5 hash. I click this button and I hope it works. It doesn't, but I have prepared stuff. No, I didn't. All right, let's assume it's 4. So what this is basically a website which has indexed lots of clear text to MD5 hashes. It's rather simple. It's just 200 lines of code, which I've wrote with a colleague of mine, which sits over here as well. And what this site makes so special is that it's one of the biggest. It has around 175 hashes, which is the biggest, I think. It is open source. You can get it from FreshMeat and check it out from SVN. And I'd like you to run such a site because it's rather simple. It's a CGI script. It looks basically as, you can make it like this. And it's simple. It's simple to set up. And it has support for cross-site, how to tell. You can interconnect it between domains. You see it's another domain. So, set it up. Call me up, and we'll make a network and make Google index those strings. With that, we can use Google to reveal those hashes. I've prepared one of those there. So you just enter your MD5 hash there, and it shows up on Google. How does it work? Basically like this. If you enter this URL, you'll get such an interface. And if you follow a link, you'll get new hashes with new text with new hashes. If you follow a link, you get new ones. You get some special hashes as well, a hash of a hash, and, some random hashes. As I said, that's open source, which basically means we don't have any time or we don't have the energy and power to build it, so we'd like you to contribute. And we have lots of problems. Because we thought, design it well and program it well, everyone could do that. Let's make it really bad. And we did it the worst way. It's implemented as CGI, as you might see. So it's rather slow. It has a MySQL backend, which might not be the best choice as well. The tables are not properly designed, so there's lots of stuff to do for you. I think that's it. As you can see, we need more servers. I have 158% of CPU load of 100. And 16 gigabytes of data, which is pretty much. So just call us up, show up, contribute. That's it.
Mach mal, nimm mal deinen Laptop. Okay, the next talk will be by Rainer about the analyst block.
Hi, I'm Rainer. I just want to give a short notice about something. I don't know who of you saw this talk from Anne about her experience about being super veiled all the time, because her husband is suspected of being a badass terrorist, which is not true. But she blogs about her experience, and she does not have the nerves, although she speaks really good English. She doesn't have the nerve to blog everything in German and English, but she wants to know a lot of people, she wants to let a lot of people know about this. So some ideas were about translating this blog, and that's just what someone did so far. It's hosted here on the CCC websites. It's a blog with links to the blog entries of her, which are still not translated. This one here, you see, it's already translated. And so just if you find some free minutes and you speak German and English, just grab one, translate it, put the link here, and that's it. And possibly within the next week, her blog will be translated in English for everyone to read in English how it is if you are celebrating with your husband and your kid and suddenly 16 full-armed policemen raid your flat. Okay, this is it.
Okay, thanks. So we have two more talks. That's Super Bertram. You need any slides? Okay.
Thank you. Hello, audience. I'm Georg Schütz. I'm from supersurveillancespectacle.com, which we are the parents of Super Bertram. So our goal is to make you famous using surveillance technology in the end. So we set up cameras in public spaces, have mobile ones, have fixed ones, and they are not like normally streaming to so we are not making a closed circuit television, it's common CCTV, where the pictures are just available by some inspectors or someone. We are making public television, or we are making everything public in the end. So if you see Super Bertram here, his main functions are not working right now. He is out of battery, unfortunately. But normally he's powered with 12 volt and has a lot of high tech inside. So main thing is he has two movable webcams built in here. And if you go to his website, you can move them left, right, up, down. And he also had unfortunately, he has not right now an integrated mobile phone number, so you can call him. So you can go to his website, look out of his eyes, and call him to interact with the scenery. Huh? Oh, the number, but actually it's an Austrian mobile phone number. It is +43699112835556. But as I said, not the number is on the page, yeah? Yeah. So actually we want to change this feature to some kind of shout box where you have a chat beyond the live view. Here, this is the live view. Unfortunately, it's offline right now. Normally, you see the eyes, you click into, and they move. I'm traveling around with him. Unfortunately, he always needs a host who is making him really mobile. GPS is also under construction right now. Normally, he's hosted at the boot lab in Tacheles right now, as long as he is in Berlin. And another, and now comes the one thing is the live streaming stuff. And the other thing is his brain. His brain is Flickr. So we see here the last pictures which he took. I think it's a Schäuble t-shirt, the back of a Schäuble t-shirt. Yeah, that's about him. There's also a Christmas tree at the bootlab right now with four surveillance cameras. Here you see the last days. So it's partly it's used motion detection, partly predefined time interval. A lot of Schäubles. By now we have 38,448 photos on Flickr. So I would say it's a little bit about transparency and data flooding for sure. So thank you.
Yeah, thanks. And the last lightning talk is about the spanning tree analyzer. Here, you forgot your paper. And anyone forgot that? Personal adapter?
So my name is Christian Müller, and I want to show you my spanning tree simulator and visualization tool. I'm from Berlin, from the TFH Berlin. It's the Technical University of Applied Science here. And I programmed the software for my diploma thesis, which is on industrial Ethernet. And you must know the industry is starting to use Ethernet, and they're using it on the top level, so to monitor their systems and to upgrade the machines. So it's not that critical as you may think if you hear about Ethernet in industry. So one thing they like to do is they're using the ring structures, and they've used the token ring networks before, and when I use Ethernet and ring structures, they have one major new feature, which is when you have a ring and you want to reach a node on the opposite side of the ring, you always have two ways to go. So if the ring is broken somewhere, you can always still reach the other end. But there's also a problem with rings in Ethernet. You may know when you have when you connect switches in a ring, or you just connect one switch and two ports of one switch, you get the broadcast storms. So that means the broadcast packages will be looping in your net, and in some configurations they will even multiply, and that's something you want to prevent. So what can you do? There's the spanning tree protocol, and who in this room does know how spanning tree is working? Okay, so that's a lot. But maybe if you see a visualization of it, and then the others also will see how it's working. So I can just show the software.
A moment.
Okay, I have to start it up. It's a Python tool. And it has two windows. One is an VX widgets window, a VX Python window, And the other one is the 3D window. And here you can see your network. And you can configure your network with the buttons window here, and just like add switches or connect switches or just close the ring as you may need if you want a ring structure. And as STP is not only for ring structures but for normal networks, you can also create any kind of network here, like that one. So when I start the simulation, you will see the switch is getting different colors. You must know every switch is simulating the spanning tree protocol, so there's an STP object behind it, and it's simulating the state machine in real time. So the switches start to change the color depending on their state, and the switches are turning red. That means they think they are a root switch of the STP network. And also the ports are changing colors, and one thing, if they're turning red, that means they're blocked. So I can, double connection. Oh, maybe we'll find a bug now. But it starts simulation. And after some time, we get the root switch here. And we also see there are still packages turning from switch to switch here. We see the TX and the RX lights blinking. And we also see that there are some ports blocked. This is that one here to prevent that loop from happening. And also the other one to prevent the other loop. And we also have the upper loop here prevented from happening. So actually the red port means that it's blocking normal traffic. So hopefully there's no loop in that network. Okay, so that's the feature. And since it's a VPython window here, I can also rotate it and zoom in and stuff. And I can also show you the log file of this simulation. Which is the last one. And you see the switches with their MAC addresses changing their states, and also the ports of the switches are changing their states. And so in the beginning, you see they all think they're root mode. And after receiving some STP packets, they're starting to get to find out they're not actually root. And the log is not complete, I think, here. So let's have a look at an older log. Well, because I just closed the windows in the wrong... I don't know. Let's have a look at this one. So same configuration, I think. So one thing I wanted to show you here is after we have the one root switch, there's the last change here, and which means that after that, no other change happened, and after that, our network is stable. And this is one thing you want to know, because when you build dead networks, you want to know how fast will it recover in any fault situation. So when you simulate it multiple times, you get the worst case situation, because it's not only simulating in real time, but it's also a random offset to get it more realistic. So you can play around with the random offset, and then you can find out what's the worst case for your network. And that's what it's all about here. Okay, so this is the tool, and it's a GPL tool. You can download it from my homepage, and it's a Python tool, so you can easily extend it. It's kind of modular, and I got some ideas what we could do. I mean, you could implement other protocols like RSTP or even upper layer protocols, and you can also take the visual part and visualize normal networks, or just use SNMP or stuff. And visualize normal situations. So if you want to use that, you can just contact me, and you can also download my diploma thesis, which is in German. Okay, thank you.